produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. Robert Anton Wilson once wrote, "Perspective, use it or lose it." On this edition of Free Culture Radio, we talk with someone about drugs from a health perspective, then we hear someone talk about drugs from a counterterrorism perspective. I'm on the line with Haven Wheelock. She coordinates the Syringe Services Program at Outside In, a Portland service agency, and holds a master's in public health from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health in Baltimore. She's also a chief petitioner for Initiative Petition 44 on Oregon's general election ballot in 2020. Haven, first of all, what can be done in the case of opioid overdose?
So, to clarify, are we talking about an individual overdose event or the systematic issue of the overdose crisis we are currently living in?
Well, you know, let's start with the first case of what can be done at the individual level.
Yeah, at the individual level, being trained to have and use naloxone. Naloxone is a medication that is used to treat opioid overdose. It's either a nasal spray or an intramuscular injection, and it's safe and effective to use if someone is experiencing an overdose. If you do not have naloxone on hand, actually administering rescue breathing and getting help for folks as quickly as possible is really important. In those events, preventing overdoses are also really important. So making sure folks, if you are using substances, you're not using them by yourself in case something does happen, you have help and backup, is one great tool. Not mixing drugs. Different drugs have different risk for overdose and can make overdoses worse and more dangerous. Not using substances if you don't want to, and getting on medication to treat substance use disorder, if that's something that's important to you, are all options of ways to prevent overdose death, even if they don't prevent overdoses necessarily always.
Now, naloxone, is that available to the general public? Is it possible for people to be trained to use it?
Yeah, it varies a bit state by state, but most states now have availability of naloxone for late people to just get. Here in Oregon, you can get it at the pharmacy without a prescription, but state by state, the rules are a little different. But most places now, I believe all 50 states have legislation that allows for lay distribution of naloxone.
Outside In does trainings, right?
Hmm?
Do you do trainings?
Yeah, Outside In offers trainings for our for clients of our syringe access program, which I coordinate. We also do community-based trainings for folks as well.
So
I personally have trained thousands of individuals to have carry and use naloxone.
Now, there's new research out of UCSF Medical School that finds that a number of deaths each year have been misreported as out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, usually on the spot by doctors or EMTs who are responding. The real number of overdose deaths, extrapolating those findings to national, according to the doctor in charge of the project, Zion Sen, the real number of overdose deaths could be double what the CDC reports. Mm-hmm. Can you speculate for just a moment about the implications of that? I mean, if those findings could be applied to the nation as a whole?
I mean, so I haven't read the whole paper. I think that death data in general is, people like to think that death data is like an easy thing to get to. And so we think someone dies, cause of death, obviously we know it. But those of us in the public health world knows that it's a lot messier than that. How things are categorized, causes of death are determined, who's making those calls, varies widely across the country. There's places that use, elected officials to make those calls versus medical providers. So I think that we know that it is messier than we would like it to be. There's not a lot of standardization around how those causes of death are determined. In terms of cardiac death conflating with overdose death, I think it's really scary to think about if someone is responding to an emergency and they are assuming heart attack as opposed to overdose, are they taking the necessary steps that could be used to revive someone who is overdosing? And that, I think, would be less... I think that, like, the interventions are similar, but they are different. And so I am concerned that if someone's assuming heart attack when it is an overdose, they may be not using tools like naloxone to in that response.
And I suppose unless you've got the person's list of medications and current prescriptions, you know, right there, it would be hard to tell if it's legal prescribed medications.
Yeah, it is. And that's something like we talk about in our trainings often, is that, you know, context is really important, right? And like if someone says to me, like, because most people doing overdose response trainings aren't training chest compressions. The really important piece for an overdose response is the rescue breathing piece. And so, you know, with places that are teaching hands-only CPR, for example, where you're not actually providing breaths, you may not be providing that air that someone would need in an overdose event. And so, you know, when we're talking to clients and staff that we're training about this, it's like using context is really important, right? Like if I'm walking down the street and an elderly person collapses in front of me, I'm going to think heart attack before I think overdose. Whereas if someone says, Haven, somebody's overdosing around the corner, I've got to assume overdose. but again, those distinctions are really hard, especially if we're talking about prescription overdoses.
We talked a moment ago about the implications at the individual level, what can be done in case of overdose at the individual level. And let's go the national level for a moment. This is a good lead-in. What could be done nationally about overdose?
I mean, there's a lot of policies that really could be helpful in terms of addressing the overdose crisis. I think big picture, making sure that everyone has access to adequate health care is really important, and adequate housing. I think addiction and substance use disorder are really fed in isolation and the trauma and in trauma. And so when folks are living outside, making adjustments to their drug use is really hard, right? Like the trauma of being outside just makes it that much harder. So improving access to housing and healthcare is crucial. And just the right thing to do for human beings. I think that increasing access to medications to treat substance use disorder, especially opiate use disorder, which we actually have some really great medications like methadone and buprenorphine that are sometimes restricted depending on people's health insurance and how you access it. So addressing those and really working on destigmatizing being on those medications. I hear all too often from folks that they're like, oh, I don't want to get on medicine to treat my addiction because it's just trading one drug for another kind of thinking. And, you know, we really don't do that with other healthcare issues. No one would ever say, I'm not going to take my insulin because, you know, I should just will my pancreas to make more insulin. But yet we do that with, like, substance use disorders, and it makes me very sad. I also think we need to be considering safe consumption spaces and how we are providing places for people to use substances in a safer way, expanding access to harm reduction services and naloxone and syringe exchange services is really crucial nationally. There are places where we are doing it well, and then there are a lot of places that really don't have adequate access to those services, and so really working to build up that system of care would be really helpful.
Would decriminalizing the simple possession of some drugs, like, for instance, heroin, would that help?
Yes, it should have been on my list in the first place. I got on my healthcare brain. But I think, you know, drugs in general, people's lives are disrupted by the fear of arrest, and it makes it a lot harder for folks to access care if they need to, if they're scared of being arrested. In my dream world, we would actually be working towards full legalization. And because having substances that are created by pharmaceutical companies as opposed to being created in labs overseas is would really help to, like, create a safer drug supply for folks. That being said, I don't think here in the U.S. until universal health care is obtainable. I actually would be very nervous about what pharma would do if all of a sudden they could start selling cocaine to people who need it and or diacetylmorphine, which is legal heroin. I worry about the access issues in terms of, like, people with money being able to have the medicine and people without means not having these medications. So I think we should work on our overall healthcare system before pushing to legalize all substances. But definitely the criminalization of substance use has continued to force mass incarceration. It makes it harder for people to access care. It also, you know, here in Multnomah County, people who died from an overdose 15 times more likely in the first 2 weeks after leaving incarceration from our local jail. So this cycle of people going in and out of jail is actually very dangerous in terms of overdose risk. And so I definitely think if we can keep people out of jail, that will help people not die.
So I could say that voting yes on IP44 would be a harm reduction measure.
Oh, I fully would say that that is entirely true. I think anything we can do to reduce the war on drug users is really important. And IP44, which is a ballot initiative that will use marijuana tax revenue to increase access to full spectrum harm reduction to long-term recovery supports and treatment options for folks, as well as decriminalize the basic possession of simple possession of all substances, is definitely moving us in a safer direction and a better direction for both in terms of, like, taking away the power of police over communities, but also will really help to improve people's health and the likelihood of that they will be surviving through their substance use disorder.
Again, folks, I'm speaking with Haven Wheelock. She's the coordinator of the Syringe Services Program at Outside In and holds a master's in public health from the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And Haven, I've taken a lot of your time. Could just one more. I'm curious because there's a lot of concern that with the COVID lockdown, we have more people at home, possibly more people being depressed, and many of these overdose deaths deaths of despair. And then we also have concerns about adulteration of products on the market because of supply interruptions, and so more things get added. What do you think is going on? We don't have the data yet, but what do you think is happening out there as far as drug use on the streets?
I mean, we've seen it's been interesting since all of this started. We've definitely seen changes in drug supply markets early in the pandemic. We're not seeing it as much now, but like early in the pandemic, like, meth just disappeared off the streets, and so folks weren't able to get any, and then now it's come back. So I don't know, I'm not an expert on drug markets or cartels, but you know, we're seeing a lot of folks we haven't seen in a very long time resuming use, coming back and coming in. I think there's no way, we know that, like you said, substance use is like a disease of despair. And so I think when you have millions and millions of people who are scared, both of the virus and of the economic results of this pandemic, people who are out of work, who historically had things to do and now aren't, it's a really key thing to resume use at times like that. And I definitely would say we have been seeing that throughout the pandemic. I think, you know, how drug markets change really fluctuates. And, you know, when you have people who aren't regularly using, sometimes using, that's a really dangerous time in terms of overdose risk. Resuming use is a dangerous time frame for doing that, especially if people are hiding it from others in their community. So, I mean, the numbers will be interesting to see going forward, but I think that it's really hard for folks who are used to being in community with others, people who are attending groups, people who are using, like, having all of those kind of things, like therapy going online. It's been a really hard time for folks, and I think that really acknowledging that is really important. And I think it's easy to, when we have such an acute viral respiratory pandemic happening, it's really easy for that to be the focus and forget that there's all these other pandemics co-occurring. The epidemic of overdose in this country, the pandemic of HIV and hepatitis C that are still affecting this community, is really, that's all still there. And so, you know, how do we balance all of those things? I don't really have an answer for it, but I think it is important work that we should be doing.
And Amy, having any closing thoughts for my listeners?
Well, thank you for taking the time to chat with me, and I hope everyone stays safe, wears your face coverings, carries naloxone.
Avon Wheelock, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was my interview with Haven Wheelock. She has a master's in public health and is a harm reduction worker in Portland, Oregon, who coordinates the syringe exchange program at a local nonprofit called Outside In. Outside In does a lot of really vital work. They're a great organization. Find out how you can support their efforts by going to outsidein.org. Haven is also one of the chief petitioners for Ballot Measure 110, the Drug Decriminalization and Addiction Treatment Initiative, which appears on Oregon's 2020 general election ballot. It was originally Initiative Petition 44. At the time we recorded the interview, the article we talked about was still embargoed, and the ballot measure number had yet to be assigned. Portions of this interview can also be heard on another show I produce called Century of Lies, which is also syndicated through the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. We'll be back in a moment. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Welcome back. I'm Doug McVeigh, and you are listening to Free Culture Radio. The executive director of the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, Ghada Fatiwal, recently delivered a briefing to the UN Security Council entitled Threats to International Peace and Security Caused by Terrorist Acts, Linkage of Counterterrorism and Transnational Organized Crime. Let's hear what the Council is being told.
I'm grateful to the Presidency of Indonesia and Minister Marsudi for holding this session on this issue of growing concern to the international community. As the Security Council has recognized, linkages between terrorism and organized crime are complex and multifaceted, posing a serious threat to international peace and security. The COVID-19 crisis poses a host of new challenges to national authorities. Organized criminal groups and terrorists may seek to capitalize on and exploit new vulnerabilities, and transit patterns are shifting in view of travel restrictions and lockdown measures, adding further challenges for border security. Comprehensive and cooperative responses are needed more than ever before. In view of UNODC's broad criminal justice mandate addressing terrorism and organized crime, building the capacities to deal with these threats represents a key priority of our support to member states, and I welcome the chance to discuss these issues with you all today. It is an honor to join my colleague, Undersecretary General Voronkov, to present the findings of the report of the Secretary General on actions taken by member states and UN Global Counterterrorism Coordination Compact entities to address linkages between terrorism and organized crime. The report was prepared by UNODC and OCT in response to the request contained in the Security Council Resolution 2482. It reflects the contributions of 50 member states and 15 global compact entities and benefited from valuable UN system inputs, including from the Counterterrorism Committee, Executive Directorate, and the Analytical Support and Sanctions Monitoring Team. The report provides a valuable overview of measures taken by member states and UN entities to address linkages between terrorism and organized crime, as well as recommendations for action going forward. In their contributions, member states highlighted a range of linkages between terrorism and organized crime, often in connection to the financing of terrorism. Challenges vary by region, and some states could not confirm the existence of links, citing limited terrorist activities in their countries or constraints with investigative capacities. Linkages between terrorism and organized crime may be opportunistic, based upon shared territory or other mutual interests. Alliances may also draw on personal connections, possibly developed in prisons, in cases where terrorists have prior criminal backgrounds. Many states reported that terrorists benefit from organized crime, including trafficking in persons and migrant smuggling, trafficking in drugs, firearms, cultural property, and other goods, kidnapping for ransom, robbery, and other illicit acts. In some cases, returning foreign terrorist fighters have taken part in organized criminal activities, while in other states, organized criminal groups have been involved in transporting terrorists across borders. However, some member states also observed that criminal organizations are increasingly disinterested in cooperating with terrorist groups, potentially to avoid additional scrutiny from national authorities. Actions reported by member states to counter these threats show that many governments have taken steps to adopt the legislative policy and operational responses identified in Resolution 2482. In their contributions, member states emphasize the following measures: ratifying relevant legal instruments, including the Global Counterterrorism Instruments, the Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime, and the International Drug Control Conventions. Fighting money laundering, terrorist financing, and corruption by strengthening financial intelligence units, complying with relevant United Nations instruments and resolutions, and Financial Action Task Force recommendations, as well as building public-private partnership. Strengthening border security and international coordination, for example, by collecting and analyzing API, PNR passenger data. Implementing comprehensive responses to drug demand and illicit drug trafficking. Improving prison management to prevent radicalization to violence and recidivism. And developing strategies incorporating whole-of-society approaches to prevent and counter violent extremism. States highlighted interagency and international cooperation as key enablers for success across all these areas. Building links between FIUs and counterterrorism investigators was cited as a particular priority to member states. The importance of joint task forces, operation centers, and other coordination mechanisms between intelligence, border, and criminal justice practitioners to detect and counter crimes in an integrated manner was also highlighted. Member states further emphasized the need for cross-border cooperation to address the transnational nature of crime and terrorist threats, including through regional platforms, bilateral information sharing agreements, the exchange of law enforcement liaison officers, Interpol, and regional organization databases and tools, and through mutual legal assistance treaties. The report also identified several areas for intensified action to fully respond to Resolution 2482 and to further develop and disseminate the good practices reported by member states. National legal frameworks could be updated to include precise definitions of terrorism and organized crime offenses and criminalization of facilitation acts. More resources could be directed towards reinforcing national intelligence and criminal justice coordination and capacity through the establishment of specialized units and interagency mechanisms, as well as through a greater focus on intelligence-led policing and evidence collection and preservation, including the electronic evidence. Targeting entire organized criminal or terrorist networks where building criminal cases should also be a priority. Further needed steps include strengthening land, air, and sea border security through data collection tools, control systems, and enhanced coordination, and continuing efforts to deepen regional and inter-regional cooperation. The report also highlighted the importance of measures targeting specific links between terrorism and organized crime. For example, between drug trafficking and terrorism financing, and to stop the illicit exploitation and trafficking of natural resources, small arms, wildlife, and other goods. More support is needed to comprehensively address all forms of trafficking in persons, including when such crimes are committed by terrorist groups. Member states could also be encouraged and supported to bring all measures in line with relevant international legal frameworks, including international humanitarian, human rights, and refugee laws. These observations correspond with the strategies and good practices that UNODC has noted in its years of working in the field level to counter organized crime and terrorism, and that the office promotes in capacity building assistance to member states. Finally, the report highlights the need for more research to better understand the nature of linkages between terrorism and organized crime and the vulnerabilities of different sectors to exploitation.
That was UNODC Executive Director Ghada Fatiwal delivering a briefing to the UN Security Council on August 6th entitled Threats to International Peace and Security Caused by Terrorist Acts, Linkage of Counterterrorism and Transnational Organized Crime. Well, anyway, that's it. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Thank you to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. A big thank you to our engineer. And of course, thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Theme music for Free Culture Radio is provided by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!